There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
You're listening to Scaffold, a podcast featuring interviews with architects, artists, and designers. I'm your host, Matthew Blunderfield. In this episode, I speak with Shajay Bhushan, co-founder of Zaha Hadid Architects Computational Design Group. Shajay is also a studio master at the Architectural Association's Design Research Lab in London, and is currently a PhD candidate at the ETH's Block Research Group in Zurich, where he is researching curved crease structures and fabrication-aware geometry. I met with Shajay at ZHA's main office on Bowling Green Lane, in a disheveled Victorian complex of buildings that seemed happily at odds with the slick and seamless architecture the office is known for creating. We began our conversation in the entrance foyer, where our movements were tracked by sensors as a part of a new experiment the office is undertaking to assess relationships between patterns of use and changes in furniture arrangement. In the interview, we talk about what parametricism is and how it is being framed by ZHA as something like a design philosophy, as relevant to the production of luxury housing as it is to the creation of furniture and even new forms of collective living. We also talk about transitions within the practice from Zaha's early conceptual painting to computationally driven form finding, and more recently to the collection and analysis of building information to further inform the design process. On a side note, I've got to warn you that due to a mic malfunction, my questions to Shajay aren't always crystal clear. So if you can, try and save this episode for when you're in a quiet place. Also, FYI, the podcast will be on hiatus for the next month while I research, collect, and edit more interviews. To keep in the loop, follow the show's Instagram and Twitter accounts for updates. And now, here's the interview. I hope you enjoy it. The fact that there is a certain desire generated through certain images, certain fantastical paintings created by Hadid, that there was a lack of tools for it to allow an architecture to be generated out of.
Yeah.
And so over time, people with those tools gravitated to the practice and allowed these buildings to come into being.
Yeah.
And as I understand it, you're one of those people who make those tools.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, the group that I co-founded with Patrick in 2007, and then now there are 10, let's say, permanent employees. So the mandate is really in that sense to marry, like, let's say, the expression with the tooling and the tooling with the expression, like, so to in that sense, like, even though Zaha kind of originally did a lot of painting by hand, her paintings are very rule based in the sense it's like a set of operations, like it's not painting in the kind of idle mind sense painting. Painting where it's active, kind of, the brain is active in organizing the operations. So it is very operation based, like, because Zaha was also had a mathematical pre-education before architecture, and so in that sense, it was very, in many ways, already a precursor for digital, like, which requires that lots of things be based on rules. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, yeah, it was an easier fit, let's say, to try and pursue our, like, my own interest and the group's interest in seeing what can be the expressive aspects of computation, not only like computation as automation and computation as like just solving problems, but like also what could be the new aesthetic of this rule-based way of generating shapes, which in many ways Zaha's paintings were already that. It's just she was manually implementing those rules, and now we have, we can see see that exponentially multiply with the power of the computer, let's say. You know.
I wonder if we could talk a bit about how the practice became a computational outfit. Because it seems like these early images, these early paintings, which were incredibly compelling and like nothing anyone had ever seen, warping perspectives, skewing lines, that seemed to be the almost like the kind of bait, or the provocation, a kind of challenge, like asking a question, can this be a building? And so, in your case, you've been at the practice now for almost a decade, is that right?
Yeah, 11 years, no,
I mean, did you fall for the image, or like how did you become a part of the practice in the first place?
I mean, I used to work for, I mean, I had very little, I studied architecture in India, and so I had very little insight into the philosophy or the underlying theoretical basis for the practice, let's say. And so I knew of Zaha and her paintings, but like never about like what was her background, what was her, and a lot of my colleagues were, when I did my master's at the AA, like they would en masse join Zaha, and like whereas I decided to join Populous at that time. And then I met Patrick in a party, and they were starting a computational, they were looking for someone to start a computational group, and like I just, to this date I'm really grateful to Patrick and Zaha that like they allowed me, like a really untested person, like I don't even have a architectural, I mean a computational background, like I have a kind of social science philosophical background, like, and then I became really interested in computers just through my master's here at the AA.
Maybe we could talk a little more about your academic background then. So I know that you studied the DRL at the AA, and so the DRL is a design research lab at the Architectural Association, which has a kind of reputation for putting out work that is computationally based and visually avant-garde. When you say your background's also in social sciences, are you referring to your MPhil?
No, I did my bachelor's degree in India, and like, so it was more theory based, and like, kind of, I hardly ever had used a computer to design anything. So it was in that sense more traditional, like modernist school of thought. You know, the plan and was critical, and but also a lot of. My schooling was like based on theory and like, you know, theoretical ways to approach a project as opposed to like actually working on the plans or in the sections and working on solids. Like we didn't have much of that. It was more on history of India and like its position in modern world and, you know, critiquing of Corbusier and Chandigarh and like, you know, that kind of let's say intellectual practice and less on the actual formal practice, which that's why I found Zaha when Patrick offered the opportunity to start the group. It was like a kind of, it was a no-brainer for me, like to really, because I was always interested in computers and but never had the opportunity to apply it in architecture, and then here was the chance to do both, like.
And I know that, so you studied at the Indraprastha Open University in Delhi, and your dad is also an architect in India.
Yeah.
Your brother is an architect too.
Yeah, he works in our group now.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he's a colleague of yours.
Yeah.
And when you're describing your undergraduate degree, it sounds like it was very traditional, capital A architecture.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of, even now, a lot of fervor and excitement around how computation is changing design disciplines and architecture in particular.
Yeah.
And I, even when I hear people talk, even Patrick, for example, I get excited too. I feel like it's infectious.
Yeah.
And it feels like those involved in this corner of the discipline are in the process of making history.
Yeah.
Or at least that's how it's being conveyed.
Yeah.
And at the same time, so I feel like parametricism, if we can call it that, is not very well understood within the architectural community or just popularly as well. And so I wonder if we could just try and explain it to a general audience. What is parametric architecture? What is parametric design?
Yeah. I mean, at the heart of it, like, any, you know, when people talk about computational design, parametric design, there's at least like several levels, let's say, and one level is the basic presence of the computer in somewhere in the design process. Like, so it could be that, you know, and usually it is like you artists or a group of designers think up of a design in whatever way they're trained to think of designs, and then the computer is used only to digitize it in some sense, so it's an instrument of digitization. And then the next level up would be like if you are actually using the computer and the capabilities, its capacities for rule-based instruction, and see how simple rules, when multiplied and aggregated, can generate shape. And can then begin to address various complex constraints like structural requirements or acoustic requirements or most physical requirements, let's say things that can be measured more easily and they're like natural laws, they're more amenable. So in that sense, like, so that's the second level where, like, you know, the computer's capacities are leveraged to actually design shapes that would in one way or the other not been possible to create, because you require that diligence of the computer to iteratively apply those rules, and those can be like made up rules, like synthetic ones, like or based on natural phenomena. And most engineers would probably prefer the natural phenomena aspects, but like you could also think of like rules which like you make up, like fractals and stuff. Like there might exist some natural equivalents, but like you can also always make up like new rules. So that's one, like that's perhaps the most pleasurable aspects to most young designers about the computer. So it becomes a kind of mode of discovery, like just by typing in a few local rules, like, and globally something else comes out, which was unexpected, and so there is that delightful aspect too, and discovery, and so and I think like further on, like you could also think of a philosophy of architecture based on this kind of tooling, which then tries to position these processes in relation to the, let's say the deliverables of design, like, and what should architecture do, and so in that sense, parametricism is definitely more architectural theory, as opposed to descriptive of a process, if that makes sense. So computational design describes process, algorithmic design describes the process and the tooling. Parametricism from my understanding and working with Patrick, it tries to be a theory of architecture. It's a theory that tries to be as intimate with the tooling to propose a framework for creating architecture. So in that sense, parametricism is in a way should be discussed in relation to other theories of architecture, it's not like description of a process, like algorithmic design is a description of a process, like I think parametricism tries to build a theory of architecture based on a philosophy that can come from understanding the way the computer works, and some of it is also mathematical, and yeah.
I was just reading through parts of Schumacher's manifesto.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to read out a few lines because I feel like it helps to frame the discussion a bit.
Yeah.
And so the premise, at least from what I gathered, is a mass shift towards heterogeneity in society.
Yeah.
Centering itself around, and parametricism centers itself around the slogan, organizing and articulating the increased complexity.
Mm-hmm.
Of post-Fordist society.
Yep.
The manifesto essentially focuses on the possibility of continuous and conspicuous differentiation throughout all realms of design.
Yeah.
Dividing itself into sections such as parametric figuration, parametric responsiveness, parametric urbanism.
Yeah.
So it almost sounds like a way of seeing or understanding the world.
Yeah,
it's a design epistemology.
Yeah,
can we call it that?
Yeah, yeah.
And so this is incredibly captivating language.
Yeah,
and it kind of sets the stage for a new way of thinking about the world and how we make it.
Yeah.
Then on the other side of that. To me, is the kind of practical applications of parametric design, which have to do with analysis and efficiency and automation.
Yeah.
And it seems like ZHA, as it's known now, is doing both of those things.
Yeah.
And I guess before we get into like what specifically it's doing, I want to talk a little bit more about how the practice itself has become an instrument for computational design.
Yeah.
Because it seems like at the outset it was doing something different.
Yeah.
That was concerned first and foremost with aesthetics.
Yeah.
And with specific art historical movements.
Mm-hmm.
And that computation was a means to an end. But then over time, something changed and computation became the end in and of itself. Is that a correct...
I think computation is not internally I don't think we see computation as end on itself. We definitely think it's also not just a means, like in a way that like we could somehow do it without a computer, like so there is like a synergy that if once, as I said, like these levels of parametric design, like ultimately if your theory is also based on intimate understanding of the processes involved in digital design or computational design and now increasingly computational manufacture. Mm-hmm. So CAD, computer-aided design, CAM, computer-aided manufacturing. So these are all already leveraging the computer's powers for automation in some sense. But as I mentioned, you could also leverage the powers to think of generating shapes of incredible complexity, which almost begins to mimic things in nature, which have similar complexity by just repeating the same simple set of building blocks. You know, a building set of operations, it generates complexity. And that's what I think Patrick tries to mean by when you say that society is incredibly complex now, like people are highly differentiated. It's not like you know, most people have a 9-to-5 job, and like, you know, most people have one employer, or it's like, it's highly very varied, like society is very varied, like our communication systems are extremely complex and there's lots of information. So Patrick tries to say that computational means of design could be leveraged to come up with an equally complex architecture to support this equal, this extraordinarily complex life of the 21st century. So in that sense, computers and computational design and manufacturing, etc., become the vehicle by which we can marry complex societies with complex architecture.
Talk, I think, in the writing of yours that I've read about tacit knowledge.
Yeah.
And somehow being able to translate that into a computational process.
Yeah.
And so could you just expand on that a little bit and how that informs your the research you're doing now?
Yeah. So like broadly, we tend to operate as a group on a kind of what might be called like creation of geometry that is aware of its structural performance and also how it can be made. So the shapes are not arbitrary. So how do you create shapes which are and by shapes we usually mean curved shapes. How do you create curved shapes which there is a natural way to physically make them? So usually they represent some way of folding or stretching fabric or some kind of physical process is abstracted to create those shapes, so that like when it comes to physically making them, we can either leverage those kind of physics, like so with this curved origami, if you design a shape that can be materially realized by folding paper or folding metal, so that's what we mean by shapes that are aware of how it's going to be made. So we're saying fabrication aware shapes. And sometimes we're also interested in like structure-aware shapes, meaning shell structures and masonry domes and things. So those, let's say a dome which is aware at least on how it's going to transfer its forces down to ground. So we want to capture that idea and use the computer to explore more of that space. So what are other dome-like shapes that might be possible with this principle? Yeah,
it sounds really familiar the way you're describing it. Mm-hmm. And I think probably this idea of self-aware structure, a mm-hmm. self-aware form, mm-hmm. Resonates with earlier architectural movements as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm thinking of high tech uh-huh. In the UK, or brutalism. This idea of truth to kind of fill in the blank, be it material, structure.
Yeah.
Program, there is an obsession, I think, within design, to have the design somehow be honest.
Yeah.
And so when you talk about self-aware forms,
yeah,
computation becomes a tool for realizing the potential of that question.
And but also highlighting and heightening. Or using that awareness to express that, like even more, like to amplify it, let's say, like so. Not only, I mean, we are less interested so much, as, so to speak, in the truthfulness, like, but we're interested really on how we can visually manifest these processes. Like, so let's say we know how force flows through a curve shape, and we want to make patterns that highlight that. Or, like, for example, we know how it was going to be made. Like, let's say you're chipping away on stone, so we want to express that process as texture or as features. So certain cuts are only possible when they're made by a certain kind of fabrication process. So we kind of highlight that cut, let's say, like whether it is needed structurally or not. Like, if it is naturally resultant from the process, then we try to stylistically even amplify it. Like, so that, so in that sense, it's not so much like truthful that it came truthfully out of it, but like it has a natural resonance with the process. Let's say it's not extraneous to the process. Yeah. Mm. So if that's what you mean by truthfulness, yeah, mm. yeah.
And then at the same time, there is something incredibly superfluous in mm-hmm. a way mm-hmm. about certain design exercises that the office is engaging with. Mm-hmm. And not, I don't say that as a kind of criticism, mm-hmm. because excess and superfluity mm-hmm. is sometimes necessary when the design approach is iterative.
Yeah.
There's a lot of waste and disposal as you kind of hone in on the right option or something.
Yeah.
And so, why don't we talk about novelty
mm-hmm.
and what these new forms that you are generating
yeah.
and experimenting with signify to a general audience
yeah.
And how they become kind of commodities
yeah.
which promote a way of practicing but at the same time as of yet have very little practical application.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, that. So it's an interesting way to think of value. It's like, what is the value proposition of these methods and techniques and why should society care, kind of, right? Like, yeah.
I feel like we should try and set the stage a little more.
Mm-hmm.
And when I talk about iterative studies or superfluous objects,
mm-hmm.
what I'm thinking of are design projects at the scale of conceptual furniture,
yep.
Pavilions,
yep.
and so forth.
Yep.
So temporary structures
yep.
or conceptual forms
yep.
which allude to use,
mm-hmm.
but in fact are highly impractical.
Yep. Yeah, I mean those. We tend to do a lot of those things which are like free from the burden of architecture. Let's say because, and especially in the early phases of discovering capacities of the computer in design and also in manufacture, and I would call it a period of suspension of disbelief that like we have to. Do engage in technology for the sake of technology, like to really see what figure out like what is it's capable and how we can interface with it and so on and so forth. Like so we in that period like we do a lot of pavilions and like furniture and like because it's easy. It's easier in some of the. It allows us to focus on like bracketed experimentation, so we're not considering all the program aspects, or we're not considering like in all the economical viability aspects, etc. Like so, it allows us to develop a language, a geometric language, more in a focused way. But and that's not only us as a practice, which I think that the discipline itself has had to go through that kind of period of suspended disbelief that which is now beginning to bear fruit, I think, like because you can see in the last 10 years like enormous progress in many practices having control over digital processes of both design and manufacturing, so which then now lends us to the next stage where we can say we know the physical side pretty well. So what else can we add to this? Where can we apply it? What's the value proposition in some sense? And so more engineering-focused research groups might tend to think of like, okay, now we can also begin to address environmental sustainability, energy consumption, material consumption, and all of these things. But we as architects and as a firm, we are beginning to consider like the social aspects, like, you know, to say, can we study the social impact of these or the social value of these kind of shapes and these kind of processes and these kind of expressions? What might be the, why might people, how we might study its social impact equally computationally? So then we can merge the social with the physical, the storytelling with the science, and the consumption with the production, etc. Like so. So that's where we believe the entire discipline is at, that like there is rapidly maturing technologies and the science aspects and the physical side is maturing rapidly and allows us as architects to perhaps go back to focusing on the more intimate task of a designer and an architect to understand how people actually use spaces or what they care about space. And
I feel like for me that's the most difficult transition to understand, or application to understand. And so I watched, you gave a lecture at the AA in January of this year.
Yeah.
Called Collaborative Cumulative.
Yeah.
Realizing Architecture's Disruptive Potential.
Yeah.
Which sounds, I mean, the title even sounds like a very, it sounds like it wants to be part of a contemporary discussion.
Yeah.
I mean, just the word disruption alone.
Yeah.
Probably has its roots in Silicon Valley and startup scenes, and maybe a specific realm of innovation that this practice wants to be part of.
Yeah.
But when you start talking about the social implications of parametricism, mm-hmm. I feel like I get lost. And I wonder if we could try and unpack that a bit.
As I mentioned at the early stages, that the ultimate ambition, at least for in terms of how Patrick sets out his theory or book or manifesto, let's say, is to mirror society's complex orderings in the spatial ordering of architecture, of our buildings and the built environment, right? Like to try and see these two as synergetic and informing one another. So in that sense, we could study and we can participate in studies of computationally studying social systems. Let's say how, for example, how people consume the spaces, like how they move about, how they navigate in a space, and therefore be able to tailor the architecture to its nuanced use, not just like big block use, like, oh, this is a meeting room, and here's 30 square meters of meeting room. But we now have the capacity to see, like, within a meeting room, it can be further differentiated, like, oh, this is spaces for 3-4 people, and this is for isolated study, or, like, you know, people might break off, like, and so can we now design the space knowing that this is how it's going to be used, like, in more nuance? I mean, not to say that people didn't know how to use it, how it was used before, but, like, now we can know it in greater detail. The same way we can know in greater detail how much energy things consume, we know in greater detail how air flows through this room, etc. Like, we can also know how people flow through it. And so that's where, if we study people in a computational way and their use and their where they see, what they see, and what they like in a computational way, not just intuitively guesswork, then we can then marry a production system to and a design system to that requirement. So when requirements get nuanced, that's where we think that the digital design manufacturing workflows and languages have the most value when we can address these nuanced requirements, which prior mass production systems couldn't possibly do. Because if you make a box, you make a box. Like, you can't like further articulate any corners in it. Like, you know, so that, yeah.
So are you teaching right now at the AA?
Yeah.
And is it still the seminar called Constructed Histories?
Yeah, that's one of the seminars. I also teach a studio with my wife. We're focusing on housing.
Okay.
And again, marrying, not like looking at housing as a kind of, as though there's a crisis to be solved, but like as more as the opportunity to see contemporary living and like how we might revisit housing from ground up, like by asking the more principled questions of like what can architecture contribute to house a dynamic social community. Fundamentally question what are the minimum set of rules and regulations needed, like, and so in a way question also planning norms. So we want to kind of stay away from the kind of big block discussions, let's say, in that there is a crisis or not crisis, and that there's a developer housing and then there should be socialist housing, or the socialist housing is failing, or like we don't want to look at any of those things, but we want to see housing as a opportunity to leverage technologies of data, social network analysis, and kind of combine it with like digital means of designing and rule-based design and rule-based manufacturing. So, yeah.
A really cynical part of me is imagining this as a kind of damage control. Because I know that certain ideas that have come from individuals in the practice around housing have been controversial in the past.
Yeah.
How much input or feedback do you have from your colleagues around the kind of stuff that you teach?
I mean, Patrick started the course, so he's a co-founder at the DRL, and he still has a studio, and so there is constant engagement with the topic. So in that sense, it's not really at all damage control. It's more like further understanding the opportunities. You know, like to see housing not as like some crisis that needs to be solved, but like as opportunities to like actually design houses that people want to live in, and like why not live with friends, and like why only see it as like square meters and as number of dwellings per hectare, like, which is regardless whether it's like capitalist or socialist, like all of those discussions, regardless, like housing is kind of considered in these big block numbers and like never as individuals, like whereas you and I like obviously will have a emotional response to the idea of housing, and which is never captured in any architectural procedure. So what we want is to now say that like we have enough control over the physical side, like, so now let's try and address like some of these aspects of community and so yeah, it is looking for opportunities to apply further understand the social side of architecture in a computational way, and so there is like lots of back and forth and discussions with Patrick and others in the office, and so there's no, it's not damage control in that sense. Like, I mean, Patrick himself would readily admit that, like, he makes these statements to actually receive pushback, but consider pushback not like knee-jerk reactions that, like, most of the profession might have, like, it's like, oh, this is too provocative or too, like, kind of off the charts, like, but, you know, but if you just said, have a rational think about it and, like, kind of push back after some consideration, like, and why is it so offensive? Then, like, you know, then it's a provocation for debate, obviously, yeah.
Just further to the point about applying parametric design thinking
mm-hmm.
towards social problems or social challenges,
yeah,
or challenges of use
mm-hmm.
and program.
Yeah,
looking at the projects in the office or in your studio
mm-hmm.
that are aiming to do that,
yeah,
there's still a very strong aesthetic
yeah.
bent to them.
Yeah,
they're still using. I don't know, catenary
yep.
Formulas
yep.
or descriptive geometry.
Yeah.
These kind of formal
yep.
visual tools.
Yeah.
In a way that seems less relevant to the problems they're trying to solve.
Yeah.
Insofar as, like, just on a really basic level, these are expensive buildings
yep.
to make.
Yeah.
And so how, that must be a struggle, trying to pull yourself away from the formal and address social questions.
Yeah, I mean, we do see that's a priori. I like to say, like, yeah, we want to address the social, but not without visual aesthetical language. I mean, it's a bit like a Tesla car, right? I mean, yeah, you could pull away from the design aesthetics of a car and, like, just focus on the electric, making the electric technology work and all of that. But as soon as you say there is social aspects, like, one of them is indeed, like, people need to visually recognize and attach a kind of image to housing. I mean, so you, why not this? Like, why does it... Regardless whether, I don't think it can be an aesthetic-free study. Like, and we choose to attach catenaries and rule descriptive geometry as a priori, like, because that's the language we are most researched in, and we know the production costs of making those things, and we know we have rehearsed the physical side. So when we now address the social side, like, we are using a language which we already rehearsed. Mm-hmm. One way or the other, you need a language to attach to these social studies, let's say. It cannot happen in vacuum. So there has to be an aesthetic attached. There has to be a language attached to ordering of social processes, and so in that sense, yeah, it is a priori, but, like, it's propositional. Like, I mean, apart from saying it's expensive, like, if people say there's no real fit, because expense is, like, it's just, you know, you can always see that, like, the next set of houses will become cheaper. Like, so expense in many ways is a very loaded value judgment, because, like, what is expensive today can become progressively cheaper. But same way, like, why did people stop building, like, these kind of brick buildings and start doing reinforced concrete? Not because reinforced concrete was immediately cheaper. You know, the Maison Domino wasn't immediately cheaper. It became cheaper over time. But it clearly proposed a new aesthetic vision and a new lifestyle positioning of that architecture, which I think, yeah, is a fundamental requirement for all architecture, like, that you have to propose a new aesthetic, a new image, otherwise, you know, like, why, you know, we believe that people are less likely to be interested. Like,
I wonder if we could talk a little more about that image.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard words or terms used like fields,
mm-hmm.
Field space, smooth
mm-hmm.
space,
mm-hmm.
swarm formations.
Yeah.
And I think that I agree with you, there is a kind of burgeoning fascination around new forms
mm-hmm.
That speak to new ways of living and new ways of working.
Mm-hmm.
For example, looking at the new Google campus in California
yep.
by Heather Wick and yep. Big.
Mm-hmm.
There's a kind of ambiguity around where one particular zone ends and the other begins.
Yeah.
There's a kind of unreal tensile canopy
yeah.
over a very vaguely defined cluster of spaces.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I guess I know what you're saying in a way,
mm-hmm.
that there is a desire to further refine that
mm-hmm.
new spatial expression.
Mm-hmm.
But something I find challenging is that still these forms are strongly associated with luxury and
yeah.
And status.
Yeah.
And I mean, if we just look at the work, a lot of the work that comes out of this practice in particular, it's for a very elite
mm-hmm.
and small group of people.
Yeah.
And they become commodities in their own right that elevate the status of the person who owns.
Sure.
And so, how is it important to separate that aesthetic from that cultural association?
Yeah, we don't see that as a problem because it's not like a mono expression. Like that's where we think like our language is ours and like this kind of computationally based languages of geometry and design and. Can occupy much broader spectrum whilst remaining within the same underlying technologies and the same underlying processes. Like by varying certain parameters, like you can occupy very different kind of connotative or associative space, right? Like to say, okay, this kind of thing looks more luxurious and this looks slightly less luxurious and this looks more social and that, like because there is that extreme pliability, like which is it's not binary, it's not like it's either looks austere or it looks luxurious, it can occupy the full spectrum in between, and that's where we see it not as a problem because and many times, like the same technologies that we have applied to, for example, the design of the gallery for mathematics, it's the same thing. Similar shapes and techniques we use to design the school for refugee children, or like for stage design, or like you know. So yeah, there's like a full flexibility and adaptability to connotations and things like so, yeah. So we don't see that as a problem. Actually, we see that as a plus for that you can occupy the full spectrum.
There's just a few more topics I want to cover.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious about how personal research interests
mm-hmm.
Of yours get brought back into the practice
yeah.
at ZHA, and how much steer you have. In terms of influencing the direction a certain project would take in the office.
One of the really understated aspects of Zaha as a person and also as a practice and Patrick also is the amount of risk they take with young people, you know, like so the opportunity I was given, I mean, though it is unique, I think, the Maxi is the end result of a group of people joining when they were maybe 25, 26, and building their supplier chain, building their aesthetic language, and through little projects and so on and so forth, ultimately manifesting in the Maxi. And likewise, Baku. Yeah.
When you talk about the Maxi, you're talking about the museum in Rome, is it right?
The museum in Rome, yeah. And
so
yeah. Yeah, exactly. So that museum in Rome it took 10 years. I mean, partially for economical reasons, but also, you know, like the team that built it, like also grew in confidence by doing several other experiments and competitions and so on and so forth. Likewise, the team that delivered ultimately the cultural center in Baku was similar. They grew in the office through a series of competitions and developing their language. And I think, like, similarly, we aspire to, as a group, to have our own physically built, manifested body of work, like that. So that's one way that, like, we think we steer the output.
By we as a group, you're referring to the code.
Computation and design group. And then also with me personally, like, because Patrick has been very instrumental, like, because I affiliate a lot with his emotion-free, rational ways of dissecting things, and also his tradition of analytical philosophy, and so in that sense, he's been very influential, and he's been very supportive of the group. And for example, he's very clear that we don't necessarily need to make profit, for example. Like, that's, I think, a very rare cushion and a buffer. And so our mandate is indeed to create novel tectonics, which I think for a research group is very unusual. Like usually a computational research group is required to automate processes, and I mean, not to say we don't do that, we do that, like, but we don't actually talk about that because that's a less interesting aspect, I think. Yeah.
The way you're describing the kind of opportunities the practice has given you,
yeah,
makes it sound like this place can function as a kind of incubator.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I'm thinking of some of your colleagues who started here,
yeah,
but then left.
Yeah.
To establish themselves independently.
Yeah.
And in particular, there's this group called AI Build by Dagan Kam.
Yeah.
And then Automata by, it's led by Mustafa El Said.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there's a handful of others as well.
Yeah.
Who've kind of branched out and started companies that are in some way affiliated with or tied to computational design.
Yeah.
And automation.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious what you would do if you were to branch out as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting question, period, also. I think that talking to Mustafa recently, he was saying that, like, you know, they're in the startup venture capital world, there suddenly seems to be interest in founders who are architects. And Mustafa is one. But, like, I also know from ETH and other places there, people with the architectural background are somehow being sussed or actively sought to, because they seem to have the necessary, let's say, technical capabilities. Like, if you're computationally based, like, I mean, most startup worlds require that you understand the world of coding, and regardless of what you're doing. So that aspect is covered, but also I think the kind of multifaceted educational system of an architect and the ability to negotiate friction and also the kind of soft skills of interpersonal relationships and the ideas of presentation and, like, you know, clarifying your ideas through dialogue, all of these are naturally part of the architectural education, which seem very well adjusted to the new world of startups and venture capital, and, like, where you always have to straddle many things, you know, like, there's no clear 9-to-5 position that you can occupy and be a successful entrepreneur, like, so. In that sense, to me, yeah, it's very interesting, and, like, I think also good demonstrator of like the value of architectural education and computational design and computational design thinking, that like architects can branch out and do other things. But now I think like the startup world is like less of an interest. Like I would like to be part of an incubation process of other startups, because I think what we are most capable of, or my own skills, is more best adapted to straddling the conceptual and the theoretical and the philosophical, let's say, with the practical. And so in that sense, like, yeah, I would hope that like Zaha sees, like, in the near future, like UN Studio or Thornton Tomasetti, that like they become the incubators of architectural startups. Like, I mean, which is different from technology startups of Mustafa or AI Build. Like that's a good thing. But I think there can also be architecture-specific startups, which our experience can help incubate, I think. Like, not only ours as a group, but also Patrick as a and our CEO, who used to be a CEO of Foster's. Patrick as a both a philosopher and also a practical. I mean, he was instrumental, apart from Zaha, to in transforming the startup of Zaha into a 400-person company and so on. So I think transferring that experience and making more architecturally successful startups, like, would be what I would, if I were to kind of branch out like and leave the office, that's what I would hope to still do, like, in relation to the office, like, because I do think it's one of the really unique places to incubate architectural startups in the computational sense, because I don't see many other companies able to do that.
I know that we have to end soon. I'm just like, I don't know, I feel like there's something else that I haven't been able to quite articulate, mm-hmm. but I feel like it's quite exciting about where the practice is at right now.
Yeah.
Because it feels like it's obviously in a state of transition.
Mm-hmm.
But not only in terms of leadership,
yeah.
but in terms of its design agenda.
Yeah.
And it sounds like it's becoming a practice that is as concerned with information
yeah.
and analyzing information
yeah.
as it is with the production of novel forms.
Yeah.
And so, I guess, how do you, if you were to forecast the direction of the practice,
yeah.
Do these two things begin to run in parallel? Or is there a kind of tipping point where information takes hold?
Well, I mean, the way Patrick positions is that, like, architecture is information that, like, people browse and, like, are able to navigate and understand what the room is for and how they should behave, or so on and so forth. So in that sense, in Patrick's world, all is information, and architecture is information too. and we are in the business of organizing that information in an easy to digest way. And how far we can operationalize that statement is still up for question, but I think that would be our kind of more focused attention is to address new architectural tasks in greater and greater detail. And so information is bidirectional, like, so we need information about society, and then architecture tries to make use of that and, like, help people understand complex society and the complex information systems in whatever capacity architecture can communicate that, right? I mean,
Jorge, thanks so much.
No, thanks a lot, Matt.
You've been listening to Scaffold. The show is produced by me, Matthew Blunderfield, and the theme music is composed and performed by Andrew Rayworth of the band Stanley Park. Additional music this week is by Fortet. Subscribe to Scaffold on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and follow the show on Twitter and Instagram at @Scaffold_podcast. Thank you to Shajay Bhushan, and thanks to you for listening. I'll see you again next month.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.